It's hard to get your loved ones to change their habits, let alone change world history. But that's exactly what happened with apartheid.
A demonstrator has run right through the play.
Australians and millions of others took a stand and helped to bring the racist South African regime to its knees. I'm Sesonke Msimang, and join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. ABC Rewind, Boycott. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A few years ago in Melbourne's Crown Casino, accused murderer Steve Fabrizi is talking to someone he thinks is a crime boss, but is actually an undercover police officer. Slowly, Mr. Fabrizi starts to tell him what happened at Irma's house. I'm Stephen Stockwell. Welcome to episode 6 of The Case of the Two Intruders.
Irma Palasik's brutal murder rocked her family and has haunted them for 24 long years.
This wasn't the average robbery.
The brutality of the attack shocked the community.
They were virtually tortured that night.
Violently assaulted before the two men ransacked the premises and stole cash and jewellery.
My grandparents were beaten and my grandmother was left to die on the lounge room floor.
An entire world was built around Steve Fabrizi by federal police, a fake criminal network, one that asked him to tell the truth about what happened in Canberra in 1999 so they could make it go away. It is an incredible story that Elizabeth Byrne, Canberra court reporter, has been witness to over the last week. Liz, welcome back to the pod.
Thanks, Stocky.
And as well as Liz, we're also very lucky to have investigative reporter James Viver, who has been in the Canberra Supreme Court as well. Welcome, James.
Hi, Stocky.
Liz, before we get too deep into this, can you give us a wrap-up of the last week in a minute or so for us, please?
Well, this week the trial shifted up a gear and we went undercover in the Melbourne Crown Casino. The court got to watch a secretly recorded conversation between Mr. Fabrizi and his crime boss, who turned out to be a police officer. We heard some more DNA evidence, including from the scientist who linked the two men on trial to the water jug and milk container in the fridge. And we delved into the ups and downs of the police investigation, which included a bid to flush out information on national television. And the mysterious white van reappeared.
Thank you, Liz. I'm glad we have some sort of resolution to the mysterious white van, and we will get to that in this episode. But first, we have to start with this undercover police operation. This is the culmination of years, decades of police work as an undercover police officer sits down with Steve Fabrizi in Crown Casino. Liz, what does Mr. Fabrizi tell this guy?
Well, first of all, Steve Fabrizi says, what? You know, I've never been to Canberra. And then eventually it's revealed it's actually a murder scene. And he's totally shocked and says that he has had nothing to do with that. He's quite scared about it. And then the undercover police officer says to him, well, you've got to tell me the truth because I can't have you around if there's trouble. And Steve Fabrizi gradually admits, yes, he did come to Canberra. And he came to Canberra to help a man called Joe with a burglary. So among the admissions Steve Fabrizi eventually made to UCO Danny was that he was there, he was outside, he was the lookout, which is his case, and he heard the struggle inside, and he actually heard Irma Palasik saying, don't hurt me, and he couldn't say whether it was Hungarian or English, but he heard her say that. But he didn't go inside because he said Joseph Facconi had big muscles, he was a strong person, and he seemed to be a little afraid of that. And Joe had told him that there was between $50,000 and $100,000 cash in the house. And he went along, but he didn't know that Irma Palasik had died.
Yeah. James, can you set the scene for how this evidence was presented to the court? Are we listening to an audio recording? Are we watching a video? How's this unfolding?
So, as Liz says, this was a covertly recorded video. Also, the audio was recorded. They were recorded separately and put together, we were told, in court. The jury sits and watches it on a big screen in the court. And now, don't forget, of course, the judge and everyone at the bar table and everyone in the public gallery watches along. Steve Fabrizi is also watching, as is Joseph Ficcone, who are both in court. So you've got this scene of one man watching himself being secretly recorded that he didn't know was happening at the time, obviously, because it was part of an undercover operation in Crown Casino, as you said. And what we see on the screen is Steve Fabrizi sort of top center of the frame in this circle of clear vision. So a bit like the beginning of the James Bond movies, you know, where you see him down the end of the barrel of the gun. Mm-hmm. Imagine that. He is at the center of this circle, which is taking up sort of about 20% of the screen. Everything else is kind of blurry. You can see Steve Fabrizi there. He's wearing a dark suit with a dark shirt. He's kind of sitting in a room, which is pretty nondescript because everything apart from him is basically blurred. You can see a bit of movement around in the sort of fringes of the image, but you can't really see what it is. And he sits on what appears to be a sofa or some kind of chair, and slowly but surely, and UCO Danny really works hard over several hours to extract this information from him almost word by word.
Yeah, as you say, this is a really long process, and it's not one, Liz, that he's initially that forthcoming about either. You're talking about how initially he says he wasn't there, he had nothing to do with this, and slowly this comes out. I mean, how does he initially kind of start to tell a story about how his DNA might have ended up at this location?
Well, he tries to explain away the DNA, saying someone must have planted it there, and part of his explanation is that there was a particular house he lived in and somebody had come in one day and taken his fishing gear, some greasy clothes that he'd left there, and because he worked on trucks and things, and a water bottle. And he said they must have taken it, they must have planted his DNA. At one point he talks about, you know, someone's trying to stitch me up.
You got the sense there was a real pattern and a real pre-agreed almost script that UCO Danny was following in what we now know as an interrogation, but came across or was presented to Steve Fabrizi as the crime boss trying to help out one of his crew, essentially. There was this almost a rhythm to it, and we heard from UCO Danny in court. The jury heard him give evidence, and he reiterated some of what we heard in the openings about this undercover operation, but which by this point had been going for several months during 2023. And as you say, this was the culmination not just of that operation, but of years of police work. And so he follows this script, and it starts off quite calm, and slowly but surely it builds up. His language becomes more blue. He F's and he Jeffs. And there is this pattern that I noticed that is, it's sort of almost quite, feels as though it's following a script, and it's almost quite filmic in a way. He sort of presents the problem. He describes the stakes of the problem. He loops back and he reaffirms that there is a relationship and that there is this trust. And don't forget, by this point, Steve Fabrizi has committed what he thinks are several crimes, which he has been paid for as part of this crime syndicate, not knowing that it is, in fact, they're all undercover cops. So he reaffirms this relationship and trust and then offers this solution, all, as I say, while escalating the language, escalating the tone. And every now and again, he'd loop back and apologize for getting angry. And then that was almost the reset and off he'd go again. And it was just this almost loop of them saying the same thing. And every time they went through this cycle, just a tiny bit more was wrung out of Steve Fabrizi.
Yeah.
And remember, by this point, he completely trusts and believes that he has been working for this crime syndicate that he has been paid for over several months.
Yeah, and we're talking about this guy, you know, UCO Danny, in inverted commas. Who is this guy?
Well, he's an undercover officer who goes by the name of Danny, so I'll be very careful of anyone I meet called Danny in the future. The interesting thing is he was posing as the head of this fictitious syndicate. There were other people involved in it. And in the evidence we heard, there were about 30 interactions with Steve Fabrizi over this period that ran between January 2023 and September 2023. Now, only three of those were with this person we now know as UCO Danny. So we know that one of those interactions with UC O'Danny was to go to the international airport to pick him up one day. So Danny was only a small part of this story, really. Other people had reeled in Steve Fabrizi and got him involved in what he thought was criminal activity.
Yeah. Such a long operation, 10 months or so, January to September 2023. Whenever I have the dates of these things, I always try and put myself in, what was I doing at that time? Completely oblivious to this undercover police operation that was running in another part of the country, trying to find someone who's involved in a murder in 1999. James, you're talking about how, you know, UC O'Danny would get angry and then reset the conversation. I mean, what was some of the tension in the recording and in the video that was shown to the court?
It was, as I say, this cyclical conversation where Danny would seemingly ramp up pressure. And he would, as Liz has sort of mentioned, you know, he would say, you've got to tell me the truth. You've got to effing tell me the truth. I can't help you unless you tell me the truth. You know, why don't you trust me? And kind of really what we now know was sticking to a script and pushing presumably pre-agreed emotional buttons, levers to try and get that information out of him. There was a moment where they almost took a break and Steve Fabrizi was given some water and asked if he wanted something to eat. He said no. And so there was almost sort of a pressure valve moment, what felt like about halfway through or thereabouts. And then it was, you know, back on for young and old until it culminated in Steve Fabrizi having given all he could give. Now, you remember, this is an undercover officer who knows or suspects Steve Fabrizi to have done X, Y, and Z, and he is trying to essentially complete his undercover police officer bingo card and get every single piece of information on that secret recording. Obviously, Steve Fabrizi doesn't know this, so you can hear him trying to colour in all the way to the lines and get every tiny little bit of information that he can. And there is a sort of strange tension in that, as you say, because everyone knows where it's going. You don't know if he's going to get there or if he's going to get every last ounce of what the jury, you know, needs to hear from the prosecution's point of view.
And talking about that trust as well, how he kind of builds that and has that with UC O'Danny and Steve Fabrizi kind of trusting each other, I guess, in this situation. I mean, James, is there any moment where Steve Fabrizi kind of questions that or wonders if UC O'Danny might have it in for him in any sense, or this fake crime boss, basically?
So UC O'Danny, our fake crime syndicate boss, did bring up the, at that point, $500,000 reward as part of the public police operations, the Who Killed Irma campaign for shorthand, and the court was shown some placards and so on around that. But there was a hesitancy that was communicated in this video from Steve Fabrizi about telling this information because UC O'Danny, the crime boss, might actually use the information to essentially get the $500,000 reward. This came up via Danny trying to extract who the other person Steve Fabrizi was with on that fateful night in 1999, and he sort of gets some of the information out. And Danny uses the mechanism of saying, oh, this guy Joe that you're talking about, who was there with you, can we trust him? If he knows, where is he? Where does he live? What's he doing now? How often are you in contact with him? Because can we trust him not to dob you in and get the reward? Mm. You know, what could he actually claim it? You know, because your DNA is connected to the scene. That's what we found out. He might dob you in. And then it, through that mechanism, there was a bit of a plot twist because Steve Fabrizi said, well, you might dob me in. And the crime boss kind of flares up at that, and I sense was a bit of improvisation, perhaps, you know, and there's a bit more effing and jeffing, and but he loops back again, and sort of goes again. We didn't really hear any detail about the crimes that the fake crimes or the fake criminal operations that Steve Fabrizi was supposed to have been involved in as part of this operation and gaining his trust. But there was one moment where the crime boss, Danny, said, $500,000, come on, mate, you know, you'll earn that on the next job. I could earn that in a week. And so there was just that one glimpse into the kind of scale, perhaps, of this fake crime syndicate that was being presented to Steve Fabrizi.
Yeah, and I mean, we've We've heard previously in the trial that about $30,000 was stolen from the Palasik's home in 1999. Was this undercover officer able to get any information out about how much Steve Fabrizi made from that robbery?
Well, we heard that when Joseph Facconi came out of the window, allegedly, and he had the $30,000 that had been stolen, that he gave $12,000 of that to Steve Fabrizi. That's as much as we know about that. Mm-hmm. But yes, we did hear that.
Yeah. And after the court watches this video of Steve Fabrizi in Crown Casino with the fake crime boss, UCO Danny, we then shown video of his interview with police. Now, this is after he has been arrested, after this interview, after they must have gone through all this information and decided that they have enough to kind of execute a warrant and have him arrested. And there's this interview with Craig Marriott, who is the lead investigator on this case. Is this where Steve Fabrizi finds out that UCO Danny, the fake crime boss who he thought he was talking to, was actually an undercover police officer?
Well, it may have been. The police formally informed him during that interview that actually UCO Danny was a police officer, or that Danny was a police officer. They also informed him that his DNA wasn't just found in the house, it was found in the kitchen of the house. And so knowing that the police knew this information, Fabrizi looked quite defeated in that interview. And he says things like, I'm very stressed, I'm very tired. And he talks about being totally ashamed of having been involved in something where someone has lost their life. It was a sort of a, almost like an anticlimax after the interview that he did. Well, he didn't know it was an interview, but after the conversation he had with UCO Danny, it was a bit of an anticlimax.
He appeared to be in total shock, or that's how it came across to the court anyway and to the jury. He couldn't really form a thought. He was really struggling to get out sentences about what appeared to be relatively basic information. Craig Marriott tried a few different, you know, open questions, closed questions, you know, tell me about your involvement, putting statements to him for yes, no answers. There was a couple of times where the recording of the police interview was paused, where Steve Fabrizi asked for medication and then he asked to speak with legal aid, and that ended up happening. And so it was a very different Steve Fabrizi that you saw in the undercover recording versus in the police recording.
And it's worth pointing out at this point, you know, we're talking about Steve Fabrizi's alleged involvement in the murder of Irma Palasik in 1999. He has pled guilty to being at the house in 1999. So we've talked about that in one of our earlier episodes. So he's not saying he wasn't at the house. He's simply pleading not guilty to being involved in the murder of Irma Palasik in 1999. We've had such an interesting insight into the investigation as a whole over the last week. You know, we've talked about a period in kind of the early 2010s, you know, 2023, 2024 is the period we've been talking about so far. But, you know, this investigation stretches back to 1999, all the different stages before the police start looking at Joseph Facconi and Steve Fabrizi. Liz, what are some of the other leads that we've heard them go down?
Well, there were quite a few blind alleys. The initial investigation was run by a man called Bob Peters, and he appears to have organised a fairly thorough look into the family or their associates. There was even a person who said that he'd been there, but that was ruled out after checking. So there were a lot of things investigated, and they yielded nothing. But perhaps the most interesting phase of this was in 2012, a review was called, and that was run by a detective called Jared Dunbar. And he discovered a link between some DNA from another crime scene at a robbery of Canberra's Pitch and Putt facility. And he decided that he would resort to the national media to try and see if he could flush someone out, because they believed that the people who'd been involved in the Pitch and Putt robbery were related to the people who'd been, or to someone who'd been involved in the Palasik's burglary.
Right. So they're kind of working on this sort of familial link, trying to get someone kind of attached to that. And yeah, the way the police go about this is kind of fascinating. There is this public campaign, there's rewards, and there's a coordination with 60 Minutes, with Channel 9, you know, with a media outlet to try and build public interest and push people out, right, James?
Yeah, that's right. And as Liz said, Jared Dunbar appears in that program that he was asked about that during his evidence in court, and the jury heard, he was asked, did you overstate perhaps the significance of this familial link lead? And he said, yes, we did. And this was as part of a general principle that we heard from both Bob Peters and Jared Dunbar in, which is a general principle of policing where it's sort of obvious when you think about it, but it was interesting to hear them talk about it, about how they calibrate and adjust the information that they give to the public. And they keep things back. And that is so that if people do come forward as part of the appeal and they give information that hasn't been made public, then, you know, they know that that's a good lead. And so it's sort of obvious when you think about it, but that was done both in 1999 when they started releasing information and appeals for help as part of the Bob Peters investigation, and again through this 60 Minutes report. And Jared Dunbar talked about perhaps overstating this, the significance of this evidence, in the hope that it would flush, frighten, whatever adjective or verb you want to use, someone out of the woodwork and try and move that investigation on.
Yeah. I mean, when you're talking about limiting information, I mean, what kind of information were they withholding? What weren't they letting out so they could use it to confirm details?
Well, one of the things that we've heard a couple of times now is the amount of money that was stolen from the Palasik's house in 1999, which we now know is $30,000, of which, as Liz said, Steve Fabrizi kept 12,000. That information was kept back, and it was one of the details that cross-referenced Steve Fabrizi's involvement because he knew how much money had been stolen.
I mean, talking about this 60 Minutes investigation, the pitch and putt kind of potential link, all of the Who Killed Irma posters and this $500,000 reward, is this how Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Ocone end up in the picture? Is it information from this period that starts the police down this trail?
Sadly, no. The familial DNA went nowhere. We had an expert about this come and talk about it, and she confirmed that it turned out there was actually not a match there. Familial DNA is really, you get a sort of a steer from it, but it often turns out not to be the case because somebody not related to you can have very similar DNA. And some of the police investigation uncovered the fact that there was no link. Mm. So that was separate to the science. But Jared Dunbar did achieve one thing. One of the things that had happened since the case went cold in about 2002 was there was a box of tape lifts from the balaclava from the original robbery in 1998. Now, the tape lifts were in a box somewhere, no one quite knows where it was. Jared Dunbar realised that could be important, and so he did a big search for it and found it. And the material collected off that showed that there was a link, a forensic link. He said that was the first time they knew there was a forensic link between the burglaries. So that was an important step forward. He thought he had another step forward, but actually he would have to wait another decade to see the fruition of his efforts.
Yeah, the highs and lows of these investigations is kind of incredible. You know, you have this, the pitch and putt that goes nowhere, but then this link between the balaclava from the 1998 robbery of the Palasik's home and the 1999 robbery where Irma Palasik's is killed. And you've got the balaclava from 98, the milk jug and the water jug from 1999. James, what did we hear about those DNA likelihoods, those DNA matches?
Yeah, and as a reminder, the prosecution says that the 1998 DNA belongs to Joseph Ocone, as does the 1999 water jug DNA, whereas Steve Fabrizi's DNA, it's alleged, belongs to or was found on the milk container. Both of those containers were in the fridge. And so we heard from the biologist called Jennifer Stone. She talked to us about the retesting that she did, and she explained a lot of the theoretical testing and some of the science to the jury as sort of part of a presentation, and then she went to the actual case in hand, the matter in hand. And you might remember last time when we were talking about the DNA, about the 100 billion times more likely to be from Steve Fabrizi or Joseph Ocone in this case than from someone else. What we actually heard from Jennifer Stone is the numbers go higher than that, but they sort of stop bothering at 100 billion times because it starts to become meaningless. And some of the numbers that we heard in court, I didn't even know existed, or at least the terminology. Obviously, numbers go on forever, but your quintillions and your sextillions, numbers that have so many zeros after them, it's enough to make your eyes water.
Yes, and I was very taken with the judge's interruption when he explained to us all that one of these figures had 22 zeros.
Yeah, I'm almost glad that, you know, they kind of stop at 100 billion because, I mean, I can barely comprehend 100 billion as a number, let alone any numbers that go higher than that. So I do appreciate the discretion, I suppose, or the judgment of the biologist in this sense. And, you know, we've heard from the prosecution that the DNA is such an important part of the case against Joseph Ocone and Steve Fabrizi for the 1999 murder of Irma Palasik. It being such a strong part of the prosecution case, it's something that the defence is very keen to, you know, kind of challenge as much as they can. Liz, what's the defence focused on when kind of cross-examining some of these witnesses around the DNA?
Well, we already know their key issue is contamination. And we've heard about a few things, including a washing machine study, which shows DNA can be transferred in the washing machine. I'm going to be very careful about who uses my washing machine in the future. There's also the idea that of DNA being transferred while you're traveling for a long distance in a car with someone else. Now, we know that Steve Fabrizi says that he and Joseph Ocone drove to Canberra, it would have been for 7 or 8 hours in the same car, and there's been some questions about, well, could there have been a transfer of DNA by that means, because their DNA would have been on each other because they were in close proximity. So, and part of this was interesting in that the scientists told us about how often when you're doing DNA testing, you're testing saliva or blood or something like that. But there's also trace DNA, which is when you've touched something. So it's really more of a dry thing, but transferred DNA is a factor in this as well. So we've had quite a good lesson on it.
We should say on the washing machine study too, because I think we mentioned that last time, Dr. Jo Lee said she hadn't heard of those studies, but Jennifer Stone said she had. Right. So that was interesting to note.
The sharing of DNA, or the ability for DNA to end up on someone else on a long drive, is a really interesting kind of thought. I hadn't actually considered that before. I mean, it does make me wonder a little bit about what someone might be doing on a long drive to result in the transfer of an amount of DNA, but we are not here to judge. Liz, speaking of drives, you know, we've spoken in the last couple of episodes about this mysterious white van that popped up over a week ago now in the evidence. We have now heard the detail about a roll of tape that was found in this van with blood on it. What has happened here?
Well, this goes back to the original police investigation, which was led by Bob Peters, and this is where we heard a little bit more about it this week. He had ordered an investigation into every single car or van stolen around the time of this incident in the lead up to it, because he said people who do things like this need something to get there and back from. He said that the white van was gone over and a roll of tape, similar to the tape used to gag both the Palasics, was found in the back of the van along with some cable ties. It was an electrician's van, so these were things that an electrician would have anyway. But when the roll of tape was tested, it had Irma Palasik's blood on it. So they thought that the van might be linked. And then there was another roll of tape found inside the Palasik's house. And they tested that and found it had a female's DNA on it that wasn't Mrs. Palasik's. But when they retested that one, they discovered it was one of the biologist's DNA. And so they had to take extra precautions. The blood, in fact, has been explained away as they decided that there had been a contamination of the tape from the van. And that's why the van was in the frame, and the police dismissed it when they decided there was a contamination.
Right. So the roll of tape in the back of the van, which seemed to have Irma's blood on it, actually didn't, or well, did, but had sort of grabbed that from some other exhibit that had been stored. I mean, that seems like the sort of thing the defence has been focusing on quite a lot, right? This contamination of exhibits and the like. Is that something that the defence barristers of Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Vicconi have been asking questions about?
Yes, absolutely. It is a focus of theirs. And obviously fits in with their scenario that there was contamination at the scene and best practices weren't followed.
Mm. And while we're on the defence, just on the DNA evidence as well, Sky Jerome, Steve Fabrizi's barrister, did ask Jennifer Stone about, but you can't be certain when it comes to our 100 billion or quintillion or whichever DNA sample or large number you want to pick, but she said, you can't be certain, you can't be absolute. And Jennifer Stone described, no, that's not how the science works, because we haven't tested everybody on the planet. We can't definitively say this is absolutely this person's DNA in any particular scenario. All we can do is give a likelihood ratio, and that's when we return to those sort of playground style numbers, you know, your quintillions and so forth.
Enjoy the description of them as playground style numbers, James, because really they exist in a kind of a different plane of numbers. I'm sure we'll get emails about from mathematicians and people who are much more familiar with numbers than I am correcting me and explaining the importance of them, as well as all of the other wonderful emails that we get to thecaseof@abc.net.au is our email address. And if you have any questions, please get in touch, send some questions through or some thoughts or reflections. We have a question here from Ruby. She's got a question about the pleas that each of the defendants have entered, and it's also relevant to some of the information we've heard in this episode about Steve Fabrizi and what he's told police during the undercover interview. Ruby's question is, if Steve Fabrizi admits to driving to the victim's house and being the lookout for Joseph Vicconi, does that not imply / prove that Mr. Vicconi was also there?
Well, it's only an allegation, especially given that Mr. Vicconi, as far as we know, denies ever coming to Canberra. So that's all still in contest, and I guess only the jury can decide that in the end. But it's not proof. It's only an allegation.
Yeah, it's an astute question because, yes, whilst they're both being tried together, Joseph Vicconi and Steve Fabrizi, they do have a different defence, each different defence barrister, and the points that are being argued to try and convince the jury that they didn't do the crimes that they are accused of are different, and the lines of questioning definitely cross over, but ultimately the jury will be asked to believe a different set of things for each man.
Yeah. Thank you, James. Thank you, Liz. Thank you, Ruby, for getting in touch with The Case Of and sending us an email at thecaseof@abc.net.au. We don't have another question per se, but we do have what I call more of a statement from Laura. And James, this is a shout out to you. Laura works in a lab and has emailed congratulating you on your definitions and pronunciations. She never expected to hear electropherogram mentioned outside of the lab. She's also helpfully mentioned that they refer to Eppendorf tubes as epis in the lab. So if that comes up again, Laura has given you permission to refer to Eppendorf tubes as epis. So thank you for getting in touch, Laura. We are getting so many questions as well about the different trials that we're covering at the moment, when you can hear updates on both the case of the two intruders and the case of the Wheelie Bin murder. It is lovely that you want updates and more on this, but we only have two episodes a week, so we're bringing you the most pertinent updates on both of these trials with the resources that we have. We have the case of the two intruders back in your feed on Tuesday next week. Liz, what's happening between now and then? Do we know yet?
Well, we can never know for absolute sure, but we haven't heard very much about Joseph Vicconi's defence yet. And remember, we're still in the prosecution case, and we haven't heard very much from them about Mr. Vicconi yet. So I expect that will be next cab off the rank.
Thank you so much, Liz. Thank you, James, for joining us for this episode. We'll be back in your feed on Tuesday. The Case of the Two Intruders is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. It's reported by Elizabeth Byrne and James Viver and presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. I'd like to say a big thank you to senior lawyer, our legal queen, Jasmine Sims, for her legal advice, to the ACT Newsroom, and also to Audio Studios manager, Eric George. This episode was produced on the land of the Ngunnawal, Ngambri and Wurundjeri people.